Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
100 years ago this month, Mrs. Catherine Parnell died in Brighton in England, and while she was the lover of the iconic nationalist leader Charles Stuart Parnell from 1880 onwards, she spent only 4 months married to him before his untimely death at the age of 45 in 1891. For many Irish nationalists, she was a figure of derision because of what was regarded as her role in Parnell's downfall and her central involvement in one of the great moral scandals of the Victorian era. Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, Dermot Ferriter, joins me on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Dermot.
Good morning, Claire.
First things first, when I was in school, it was Kitty O'Shea, and now I see that that was a term of derision in itself.
It was. It was a slang term in Victorian England for a prostitute. And of course, it suited the needs of nationalists who were aggrieved, who felt that she had destroyed the Home Rule movement and had destroyed Parnell, and indeed had split Ireland down the middle, that she was deserving of this label. But, I mean, that word Kitty, that use of the term Kitty in itself was an indication of how loaded this whole episode was.
Okay, because she was Catherine, of course, and Katie to her friends, and Kitty only came into it later, as we said, a term of derision. Will you tell us a little bit about her, first of all, her background and her early life?
Well, she was born in 1845 and the youngest of a very large family. There were 13 in the family from Essex. A very privileged and socially well-connected family. I mean, her father was an Anglican clergyman, John Page Wood. He'd actually been chaplain to Queen Caroline. Her mother, interestingly, was a popular novelist. She had an uncle who had served as a Lord Chancellor in William Gladstone's first ministry. And William Gladstone, of course, who becomes very much a part of the story and an iconic figure in British politics. So Catherine is born into that kind of milieu, very privileged, very well-connected. And she also has a brother who serves in the British Army, and that would have meant that there were a lot of military connections, and there would have been a lot of British Army men in the house as well.
And she went on then to marry Captain William O'Shea.
Yeah, and William would have been one of those men who had been in the house at some stage. He was actually the son of a Limerick solicitor, really part of a faded gentry family, and his father purchased the commission for cavalry infantry of the British Army, which he, when he wanted to get out of the army, subsequently sold on. And O'Shea was really a failed businessman after that. I mean, he experimented with stud farming and mines and banks and all sorts of things. And it seems to have been the case that Catherine married him after he had been asked to visit the house when she fell into quite a depression after the death of her father, the unexpected death of her father. But, you know, William O'Shea was regarded as quite a catch. And, you know, Catherine seems to have been quite taken with him, but by no means was it a happy marriage.
Okay, and then how did she meet Parnell?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I mean, after his failed business ventures, William O'Shea moves into politics. He actually becomes a Home Rule MP for Clare in 1880. And that's where the Parnell connection begins, because William O'Shea is really looking for Parnell to be more centrally involved in his own political ambitions and his own political life. And he encourages Catherine really to try and establish communications with Parnell in order to get Parnell to the house, to the O'Shea house. And he wasn't responding to correspondence. So Catherine actually made her way to Westminster. And that's where they met in the summer of 1880 in the yard at Westminster. She was 30 at that stage, he was 34. They were both very lonely people, I think. But that's their first face-to-face meeting, and there seems to have been an instant attraction. And she wrote later that this man is wonderful and different. So there's definitely a chemistry there. And I suppose you can trace the intensity of the relationship from a very early stage through their correspondence, and he's referring to her as wifey and queenie, and it's clear that the relationship was consummated quite quickly. And she also maintained, of course, that her relationship with William O'Shea was well over at that stage. They had three children together, herself and William O'Shea, but that the relationship had been over for some years.
Mm-hmm. And there's an example, isn't there, of a very frank letter she wrote to William O'Shea saying, look, we're separated now. You don't need to live here because I can't listen to you, you know, going on about how I'm raising the children, etc. So there seems to have been an accommodation between the two of them, certainly, about the end of their relationship.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, this is also about politics as well, because Parnell probably makes the mistake of kind of sponsoring William O'Shea to stand as an MP when there's a by-election in Galway in 1886. And there were some in the party who had reservations about this because, you know, whilst this is Victorian society and, you know, this would have been frowned upon in public, in private it's tolerated and there's a lot of knowledge of it. And, you know, William O'Shea was well aware of the situation that Catherine and Parnell were essentially living as a couple. They had three children together, and it seems to have suited his political interests at that stage not to ruffle the feathers.
They had three children, as in O'Shea and Catherine.
Yes, but then Parnell and Catherine also had,
they had further
three children. Claude, Sophie, Claire and Katie. Now, Claude, Sophie died in infancy. But yeah, there were three daughters there. So, I mean, that's the extent of the relationship.
Yeah.
These two had found emotional and physical fulfillment, and they were parents now as well in that union. So it really was a very close and intense relationship.
And she was a very politically engaged woman.
Well, this is an interesting thing because she would have averred that she was not politically engaged, not politically involved. But that doesn't seem to be borne out by the evidence because we know that she corresponded with William Gladstone as British Prime Minister. And of course, Gladstone is very much central to that Home Rule story in the 1880s. I mean, Parnell had remarkable political power by the mid-1880s. He was holding the balance of power in British politics. He's transformed Anglo-Irish politics, really. And we know that Catherine was corresponding with Gladstone about some of those political issues. Now, whether she's, you know, can be seen as a kind of a mentor as opposed to an emissary is open to debate. I suspect it's the latter. You know, it's not that she was designing policy, but she is certainly somebody who Gladstone, I think, sees as useful in that he mm-hmm. can take advantage of the intimacy between them when it came to trying to communicate politically with Parnell. Because Parnell could often be very elusive, you know.
Can I ask you about that connection between Catherine O'Shea and Gladstone? Was it because of her uncle and the connection that he had?
Well, you see, exactly. She came from that background. She had those connections. Those political connections were there. And, I mean, there are a lot of very fraught and delicate moments in this Home Rule saga as it's playing out in the 1880s. And, you know, she at times seems to have been taking the initiative herself in that she would have said to Gladstone at one stage, Charles doesn't know I'm writing this, but, you know. So she certainly is aware, I think, of her own power there to influence the situation.
So then he's riding high. His reputation is huge and important before the scandal breaks around the relationship and the divorce.
Well, O'Shea filed for divorce at the end of 1889, actually Christmas Eve 1889, referring to the adultery of Catherine, but also citing Parnell as co-respondent. And there was a grant of a conditional divorce decree, as it was known, at the end of 1890 when it came to court. And this is when the scandal breaks, because it's not contested. Now, you know, Catherine has a counterclaim about O'Shea's adultery. But they didn't have the money, really, to make a settlement on the back of that counterclaim by Catherine. So ultimately, it's not contested. And that means, of course, that O'Shea can present himself as the trusted, the trusting husband who has been wronged, who has been deceived, which, of course, was very far from the truth. But that, of course, was how this played out now in public. And a complication was that there was an aunt of Catherine, Mrs. Benjamin Wood, who was a wealthy benefactor, and she had died in 1890. And the question was, what was going to happen to that will? Had O'Shea stayed in the marriage in order to try and benefit from money that would have come from Benjamin Wood, Mrs. Benjamin Wood. So that is still playing out in that the will is actually contested. But the important point at that stage is that this is now a public issue. And a lot of these very unsavoury details about adultery, about deceit, about private lives, the drama is playing out in public.
Did William O'Shea have to cite somebody else in the papers?
Well, I mean, if you're filing for a divorce decree, I mean, on what grounds are you filing it? You know, it didn't have to be adultery. But, I mean, obviously that is serves his darker purposes as he sees it. And interestingly, I mean, the court affidavits did not become publicly available until the early 21st century. And I mean, I recall O'Shea being referred to as a scoundrel. I mean, that would appear to be far too tame when you look at the allegations, the counter-allegations that Catherine made, because she referred to this kind of willful neglect and misconduct, but also assault, that he had assaulted her while pregnant, that he was reckless with gambling. And the way she put it most damningly was that he habitually committed adultery with diverse prostitutes. So, you know, there's a very, very strong testimony there from Catherine herself, and he also accused her of seducing her own sister.
Okay, so it was extremely bitter then. But then we move on from that to the marriage of Catherine and Charles Stuart Parnell. That happened in 1891.
Well, it happened in June 1891, but I mean, that's after the storm. In reaction to this case, you know, I mean, newspapers at the time had a field day about this family wrecker, Parnell, and of course newspapers had their own political agendas too, and Gladstone wrote to the party and said, look, I can't do business with this man any longer. But perhaps most problematic for Parnell was the intervention of senior Catholic Church leaders, including the Archbishop of Cashel, Thomas Croke, who sent a telegram to Justin McCarthy, who was the recognised deputy of the parliamentary party, and he said, in God's name, let him retire quietly. So you have the priests and the church lining up against him as well. But they do get married
despite all of that, interestingly, you know.
They which?
Despite all of that storm of controversy,
well,
they
I mean,
went
this
ahead.
This is where, you know, their essential commitment to each other, that's how resilient it was. That's how determined that they were. Now, you know, Parnell is fighting back, and he does think that he can ride out this storm. They can't get married in a church, obviously. It's a civil ceremony. But even when you look at the reaction to the marriage, I mean, there were newspapers that were quoting Matthew 14 about adultery, and the bishops actually released a statement in response to the marriage saying that Parnell had utterly disqualified himself to be the leader of Irish nationalism. So, you know, Parnell is very determined, as he put it himself. He wasn't going to give in to the howling of the English mob. But at that stage, his political career is destroyed.
And it had a huge effect on him, we know.
Oh, there's no doubt about that, because, I mean, he fights back, and, I mean, physically he's ailing. He's still a young man, but he's suffering from a variety of different medical conditions, and he does contest by-elections, you know, as the leader of you know, his faction of the party, because the party has completely split. The Parnell faction is now in a minority. He loses those by-elections, as one in Kilkenny and Carlow during that period, and he's absolutely exhausted. And, of course, this involves traffic across the Irish Sea, because Parnell spends very little time in Ireland. But so when he's going over to campaign like that, they're actually very exhausting journeys for someone who's already physically very vulnerable.
So he dies 4 months after the wedding.
Yeah.
And she doesn't go to the funeral.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Catherine never set foot in Ireland. This, for her, it's very much an English story, you know, and that's where they're based. And now, whether she doesn't travel because of the controversy associated with her at that stage, I mean, she was actually referred to by someone in the party as a proved British prostitute. That's how venomous it was at that time. Whether it was because of that or because she was just so distraught, because this was an amazing love story. But what she did put into his coffin before it made its way back to Ireland was the rose that Parnell had kept from their first meeting, which he had kept in an envelope with the date of the meeting on it, and she put that in the coffin with him. But she wasn't at his funeral. 200,000 people were, though, in Ireland.
So what happens to her then after his death, Dermot?
Well, she lived in relative obscurity. I mean, she stays in Brighton, and she lived until 1921. And what becomes interesting is the publication of her memoir, given the privacy and the silence and the relative obscurity from her. And I mean, that memoir, you know, was kind of subtitled His Love Story and Personal Life. So people were very interested in that. It's quite one-sided in that you get his correspondence to her, but not hers to his. But I mean, it's also about a portrait of blissful domestic harmony and happiness, you know. And she quotes him about, He'll give his life to Ireland, but it's to Catherine that he'll give his love. So it's full of that kind of thing, and it's quite moving. And I think it led to a degree of resurgence of interest in Parnell. You know, people like Yeats, the poet, become very interested in the idea of that kind of lonely and quite haughty figure of Parnell cast out by people at the behest of their priests. And it does lead to a kind of a resurgence of interest in the Parnell story. And it sold very well. And it gave her a degree of material comfort towards the end of her life that she hadn't had at an earlier stage.
Did she give a sense in that book that she was felt victimised?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I mean, she felt that her story was about being there for Parnell, you know, about being in love with the most iconic nationalist politician of that generation, and that aspect of his life, of his fulfilment, was hugely important, and she was intrinsic to that. So there's no doubt that tone comes out.
So how would you say she should be remembered a century after her death?
Well, she never got over the death of Parnell. And I mean, there's a very interesting letter from her daughter, Nora, who, you know, he wrote to actually one of Parnell's biographers and about the kind of delusions that Parnell came to Catherine at night and kind of drove her out of what she called the black waves or depression, and that her periods of delusion have always been Parnell. And I suppose that's how we remember her. We very much remember her as being part of that love story. But we should also remember her as being central to a Victorian scandal and astounding period of hypocrisy. I mean, the role of the media and the church is one thing, but when you think of the pious statements that were being made by William Gladstone, look at him himself. He took advantage of their intimacy. And we know that Gladstone's own ministers, that a number of them were actually living with their mistresses at the time. And the way she put it is that English statesmen always have to be seen on the side of angels. But the reality, the private reality, was very, very different. So we should consider that wider context and the extent to which she was a victim of an astounding hypocrisy too.
It's a fascinating story, that of Catherine Parnell, who died 100 years ago this month. Dermot Ferriter, thank you as always.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.